What should a person have in mind as they're preparing for the Seder? There's no such thing in Yiddishkeit that can be successful without a little bit of hachana. The Rav always used to say, "In kedusha bli hachana." You have to make sure that you're preparing in order that when you arrive at the time where the mitzvah is supposed to be performed, that you have the proper mindset, you know what to expect, and you know how to maximize the opportunity. I think we've said before the mashal for Kabbal Shabbos, Kabbal Satorah. If a person thinks that they're going to receive Shabbos, receive the Torah, without doing something active on their part, they're making a mistake. We said Kabbalah, Kabbal Satorah, Kabbal Shabbos is Miloshon receiving, like Miloshon wide receiver. Yeah? So if you're playing football and you're going out for a pass and the quarterback throws to you and you don't turn around to put your arms out to receive, to catch the ball,
yeah.
And you just keep running down the field, so the ball is going to hit you over the head, it's going to bounce off, and you're going to keep on running. So the same thing happens on a week-to-week basis for many people on Shabbos. If they're not Makabel Shabbos, if they just sort of go into Shabbos as if Shabbos is going to hit them over the head, then probably it will hit them over the head as they run from the office back into the shower, from their house into shul, without any active involvement in getting Shabbos, receiving Shabbos, in a way that will be meaningful, and probably when it bounces off him, and he keeps on running, he'll be back in the office on Monday as if nothing happened. Same thing is true when it comes to any mitzvah that we perform. There's a hachana for the Seder. What's your hachana for the Seder? So you guys don't have children. So you don't have the mitzvah of Vigadta Levincha in the classic sense, the way the Torah describes. So it's true, the halacha tells us, that even if a person, he has kids, he doesn't have kids, it doesn't make a difference. Even if he's by himself, he goes through the Haggadah. And in theory, if there's no one else at the table with you, you're supposed to ask the questions and answer them yourself. Okay, so there's definitely a dialogue that's fundamentally the crux of the Seder. But notwithstanding, even if one would find himself on his own, and even if you're not the one leading the Seder, you don't have any kids, one thing is clear is that if that's the symbol for the mitzvah, this parent-to-child transmission, then no doubt what you should have in mind as you are going through the Seder at this stage in your life is, how is this getting me ready for the point in life in which I actually will have that mitzvah of communicating to my child the yesodos of emunah that come from the Seder. Now, the Rav used to say, in the most, more extreme, dramatic formulation, that on the night of the Seder, the father and his child, so his child is chavtesho mitzvah. The son is his lulav, okay? Meaning that in the same way that on Sukkot I have to take a lulav and I have to shake it, okay? I can't perform the mitzvah without the object of that mitzvah, so too at the Seder, I can't perform the mitzvah unless I have the object of Sibur Tzius Mitzrayim, which is the child, okay? Now, we should never, chas v'shalom, objectify human beings, okay? But we have to at least take away from that the picture that we're painting, what the Seder is supposed to look like, that there is this communication. How does communication take place? We said last time that one of the most effective ways to communicate is not just by instructing and not just by listing off bits of information, but the more that you're experiencing what's taking place on your own, the more, as the Vilna Gaon put it, you'll be an overflowing cup that naturally imparts the sense of hargasha that you feel on your own to the people around you. Okay? Dahainu, that what you should be thinking about right now is how I can maximize the Seder, not how much I can contribute even to the people who I'm having the Seder with. I don't want to take away from that. That's very chashuv. But you should be focusing more on experiencing the Seder yourself, so that when the time comes that you are in charge, when you're leading the Seder, it will be a natural transition for you to be, again, without even having to think, without having to be consciously aware of I got to do this, I got to do this, I got to do this. Rather, it should be something which I'm experiencing the Seder. By doing so, people around me also have that same experience too. And it sort of rubs off on them. Which brings us to a very important change in the girsa of the Haggadah that the Rambam tells us about. Just by writing what his version of the Haggadah is. Well, we have an Haggadah towards the end of Maggid. Let's read inside. Towards the end of Maggid, it says, "Hold over door, chayev adam liros es atzmo ki ilu yasam yimitzrayim." Okay? So we know that's a very important part of the Seder, especially because the way we prove that a person in every generation has to look at himself as if he's leaving Mitzrayim, Shenemar. What's the Shenemar, Rabosai? V'gadto levincha b'yamahu leimor, bavurza asa Hashem li b'tzeisim Mitzrayim. Okay? Just a simple translation. You have to look at yourself in every generation as if you are leaving Mitzrayim. What's the Raya Shenemar? You shall instruct your children on this day because of this Yetzias Mitzrayim, that because of the miracles, because of everything that occurred, Asa Hashem Li, that God did to me, did for me, when I left Mitzrayim, etc., etc. So Rabbi Osai, if you were writing the Haggadah, did you need to quote the entire pasuk? Did you need to start from the beginning of the pasuk? You should tell your children, because of that which Hashem did for me when we left Mitzrayim, ... Does the part about instructing your children have any relationship to proving this notion of seeing yourself as one who left Mitzrayim? No. Bavur ze asa Hashem li, just focusing on the fact that the Torah describes your experience as one that ki'ilu left Mitzrayim, you're an individual who left Mitzrayim, that should be enough to tell a person, you, Daniel Wood, okay, have to see yourself as if you leave Mitzrayim, right? What's the higad to levincha b'yom ulay more? So I think the answer is exactly what we're saying, that seeing yourself as leaving Mitzrayim is the way that you are going to be v'igad to levincha. When you're experiencing it for yourself, there's a natural ability to make sure that everyone around you picks up the vibes of that chavaya of Yetzias Mitzrayim that you feel on your own. Okay. However, the Rambam changes the lashon. He doesn't say chayav adam leharos es atzmo. What does the Rambam say? Chayav adam leharos es atzmo. Chayav adam leharos es atzmo. What's the difference between leharos es atzmo and leharos es atzmo?
Like what you saw and like what's happening to you.
Leharos, to see yourself, and leharos, like lehadlik. A leak doesn't mean I'm gonna make something else ignite. Laharos means to show other people that I should display, my appearance should give off that impression as if I'm actually leaving Mitzrayim. What's the difference between seeing yourself and displaying it? The answer is that someone on the outside can see that too. Here, you see how this is all coming together? That even if you don't feel it right now, even if when you go through the Haggadah you don't feel like I am actually leaving Mitzrayim, the first obligation, again, long term, with this picture of how I'm ultimately going to lead the Seder in the future, my own kids, but right now, even if I don't feel as if I'm leaving Mitzrayim, a person has to start by acting as if he's leaving Mitzrayim. Okay? Laharos is atzmo, because as we know from the Sefer HaChinuch, acharei pu'ulos nimshachos halavavos. This is a line you hear a lot, but you can't underestimate its value because it's true. That the more a person acts in a certain way, even if he's not there yet, ultimately, it has an impression. It makes a change. It's transformative. And he'll come to be who he is acting, even if he's not there yet. But ultimately, he will be. And nafkamina, dressing like you're supposed to dress for an interview. What's the mahalach, Jenna? Dress for the job you want, not for the job they already have. Okay? So the same thing is true when it comes to the Seder. So if you want to envision yourself, picture yourself in that picture-perfect Seder at the head of the table with your matzahs and with your silver Seder plate and all the kids crowding around, picture yourself experiencing the Seder you're supposed to, in the way you're supposed to be experiencing it, in order for them to naturally be able to bite and to buy in. Okay? Unbelievable story, boss. I heard this from Rabbi Cohn.
You need this, right?
Yitzhak Cohn said he heard from Gershon Zaks. Who's Rabbi Gershon Zaks, Rabbi Osai? Gershon Zaks was the son of Rabbi Mendel Zaks. Mendel Zaks was the bochen in the yeshiva for many, many years. And the one who administered the test when someone would come in and they had to be assigned to a shir to get into the smicha program. Mendel Zaks was none other than the Chavetz Chaim's son-in-law. Okay? Chavetz Chaim's son-in-law. Okay? It means he lived together with the Chavetz Chaim in Raden. He helped edit the Mishnah Berurahs. Talking about someone who's an important part of our Masorah and part of our yeshiva, even if maybe his name doesn't come up too often for you guys, but be aware that he was a part of our yeshiva. So he said he was once by the Seder with the Chofetz Chaim. Now, you have to remember, the Chofetz Chaim lived very, very ripe old age, given the period in which he lived. Okay, the Chofetz Chaim, I think, died, he was 95 years old for sure, maybe even a little bit older than that.
Wow.
Okay? And I heard from Rabbi Trisky once, Adam Meis, about the Chofetz Chaim. He would push himself to eat more, even at an old age. He was mamish coughing up blood, and he was moser nefesh. To be kind of in the midst of the Seder was very difficult for him. Actually, he fell asleep in the middle of the Seder. Okay. You can imagine, elderly individual. It's late at night, falls asleep in the middle of the Seder. And keep in mind, also, in that part of Europe, in Lithuania, there's manor much later. We're just talking about Scandinavia the other day. Someone was telling me about they were in for Shabbos in Brussels, maybe. Okay, the Zmanim are much later. Okay, sun sets later, and therefore the Seder would start even later than it does here in New York. So in the middle of the Seder, Chofetz Chaim fell asleep for a little while, and then he woke up. and he was back into things. But while he was asleep, they poured one of the cups of wine for him. Okay, minhag is obviously to have at the Seder, one person should pour the cup for the person next to him or another person at the table. You shouldn't be pouring your own wine, and the reason is because that's derech eres. How does a person display their sense of freedom? When you act like a king, and someone else pours it for you. Okay, because the king doesn't pour his own drinks, he has a servant who does it for him. Okay? Chafetz Chaim was asleep while they poured the drink for him. Chafetz Chaim said, pour me a new cup. If I can't watch it happen, if I can't feel, if I can't experience on my own that chavaya of having someone pour the wine for me, feeling like I'm a king, feeling like I'm the person who has the servants around the table providing for me, so that I missed out something from my chayev adam liras esatzmo kili yatzmo mitzrayim. Okay, so right now we're just sort of painting the picture of what the seder is supposed to look like for us as individuals, in order that ultimately we can be most effective in how we help others make the most of the seder. Okay, that's point number one. Question. The reason why this minhag for sure centers on the wine above anything else is because the wine is a way of expressing the cheres. For that reason, Moshe Feinstein was of the opinion that grape juice is not acceptable for the Seder. Okay? Even though many poskim, such as Rav Salvechik, did not oppose one using grape juice if they couldn't handle the wine. But Moshe said that, how can you say a non-alcoholic beverage in place of wine is going to replace the aspect of cheres that the yain symbolizes?
Wow. Okay. Would it be better to do one or two cups of wine than the last two or two?
It would be better. Let me just finish. According to the Rav, the reason why derech cheres may still be able to be accomplished through grape juice is even if you don't have the alcoholic aspect of the drink, at the same time, if I can't tolerate the wine, and my optimal enjoyment is through the grape juice, so then that could be a derech cheres in its own right. Your question, Alice wants to know, if four cups of wine I can't handle, two cups of wine and two cups of grape juice, that I can't handle. So I would say no. Instead, what you should do is the first two cups dilute 50-50. You don't even have to do 50-50, but let's say 50-50 for argument's sake, and then the last cup is also 50-50. The more that you can accomplish the derech cheres in each of the cups, the better off you are. Moreover, again, if it's going to be a difference between wine and grape juice, and you want to be yosei the wine, you don't necessarily have to finish the entire cup, and you don't have to have a huge cup. It's true that there's some posts going to say that the size of a revius, which is what the cup is supposed to hold, is as much as 5 ounces, maybe even a little bit more, according to some poskim. But Ramosha writes that a revius is 3.3 ounces. It's very, very little. What's 3.3 ounces?
This is 4 ounces, like right here.
Okay, so that's not a tremendous amount of wine. And there's some posts where we even have less than 3.3 ounces. Okay, just so you should know. Which means that the cup has to start 3.3. Let's say it's wine. And even if you only drink Rove of the Coast, you're also Yotze. Okay, and it's L'chatchil is better to drink the whole thing? Yes. If you drink the majority of the cup, that's also very significant. And what we're talking about, Rove of the Coast of 3.3 ounces, we're not really talking about that much wine. Okay.
Always have to be rove of the coast, or is it rove of 3.3 is?
Whatever, right, that's what I'm saying. You can use a smaller cup. There's no mitzvah.
So you can use a much bigger cup. Do you have to drink rove of that cup? Or do you
correct. The point is to drink rove of the cup. So if you happen to use a smaller cup, it's a smaller measurement. If you use a larger cup, it's a larger measurement. So I'm saying if it's hard to drink a lot of wine, just start with a smaller cup. Okay.
Does the cup have to be empty? Like whether or not you finish it, do you have to then pour out?
No. No, as long as when you get to the next cup, you pour fresh wine into it, right? So yeah. Like we spoke about last week, the Kos Pugim. Any kosher bracha should not be a cup that someone drank from. And therefore, if you did drink from it, you have to refill it, but you're going to refill it anyway so that you have the requisite amount. You want to fill the cup at least to begin with, even if you don't drink the whole cup. That's why when we take a little bit out for the Eser Makos in the middle of the Seder, by the time we're ready for the second cup at the end of Magid, we're supposed to refill again a little bit of wine afterwards to make up for what we took out, but also to be mamal of the coast, it shouldn't be a coast pugum. Okay?
How much do you have to put for it not to be pugum?
Even just a little bit.
Yeah,
just a little bit. It's fine.
And then how long do you have to drink the pot?
Okay, good question. So the amount that you're supposed to drink, again, the l'chatchil is the entire revius. We said before, even rover revius is acceptable. Even to drink an entire revius, it just has to be finished in the zman that it takes to finish revius, which ideally is in no more than two gulps. Okay, but if you take a cup of wine and you fill your mouth, I don't mean like bursting. If you pour a normal gulp and then a second gulp afterwards, between those two gulps, you're fine. As long don't interrupt in between those two, and you'll be yotze for sure.
All I'm saying is, let's say you want to finish the cup, but like it'll take you like 10 minutes or something. Is it better to just do the levius and then just call it a day, or like even 5-10 minutes later, you can still finish the
cup? Excellent question. So I think the initial levius for sure should be finished in no more than two sips. Once you get past your 3.3 ounces, you want to take a little more time after that. Great. Ideally, to have the rove of the cup in two swigs, which again, I think you're going to be able to do that anyway. We're not talking about that much wine. But you're right. After that, I don't think it's required that the entire cup be finished within that same shear. Okay?
Are you going to drink in between? Say, like, if you take those two right away and then stop for 5 minutes.
Okay, a few more points, then we'll take a break. Two options for one more introductory point to the Seder. If there's one thing that's very conspicuously missing from the Seder, if there's anything that you would think would be a natural focus, not just a detail, but a focus of the Seder, would be Moshe Rabbeinu. Look through the entire Seder, entire Haggadah, Moshe Rabbeinu is just missing. Right? He was the one who brought us out of Mitzrayim, and at the same time, you see that he's not figuring prominently or figuring at all in terms of the story we tell on the night of the Seder. Any suggestion why? Tzvi, what do you say? Tzvi Wolpo.
From a humble standpoint.
Humble standpoint, okay. Did Moshe Rabbeinu write the Haggadah that we should say that he left out his name on purpose?
He figured
Moshe Rabbeinu, he's probably, you know, he'd be mochel, he'd probably appreciate it if we left his name. Okay. What do you think about that?
You don't want to incorrectly give the spotlight to Moshe when really we should be giving all of our attention to Hashem.
Okay, now we're getting very warm. What's that?
Opposite of Purim.
Opposite of Purim, we go out of our way to hide Hashem's Baruch Hu. And here we go out of our way to mention Hashem's Baruch Hu, who was really the star of the show, and not to miss the boat over here and decide that Moshe Rabbeinu is the star of the show. Likewise, very interesting pshat by Rabbi Lamb in his Haggadah. He asks why it is that power doesn't have a name, right? It's true. All the pharaohs went by that title, but they had specific names, yeah? Even in Prince of Egypt, right? Is there a name like Ramses II or something like that? No, don't they have real names? I don't know, I never saw it.
Yeah.
What's that? Okay, so whatever the names happen to be. There was a King Tut, right? So they had names. Why do we not focus on Paro as an individual? So Rabbi Lam explained, because as soon as you identify an individual, so then it's very easy to get carried away with whatever characteristics that person brings to the table. Meaning, Paro was a Russia. Paro enslaved the entire Jewish people. We've spoken about in the past the fact that he did a lot more than he had to. The Ramban asks, and many Rishonim ask, why was HaKadosh Baruch Hu able to bring the punishments that he brought on Mitzrayim if, after all, hundreds of years earlier, he said to Avraham Avinu in the Bris Ben Abisarim that Klal Yisrael, the descendants of Avraham Avinu, are going to go down to an Eretz Lolahem, Avadum Yinu Asam, they're going to be subject to a foreign ruler who's going to enslave them and make their lives miserable. So what do you want from Paro? Paro did everything he was supposed to do. That this was a prophecy that came to Avraham Avinu many, many years before. So one answer the Rishonim give, is that it's true. Paro was fitting into this master plan that Kadosh Baruch Hu had for the people. But A, who said he had to be the one to do it?
Yeah.
If Paro didn't opt in, then someone else would have opted in. But no one asked Paro to be the one, right? We know he had various pieces of advice. He had three primary advisors. He had Balak. I'm sorry, not Balak. Bilam. Bilam was the one who said, let's turn them into slaves. And then there was Eov who remained silent, and Yisro who advocated in favor of the Jews. So he had the Bechir Chavshis instead of taking what would be a more appropriate response, whatever Yisro had in mind for the Jewish people. He decided to follow Bilam. So he's punished for the fact that he was the one who said, oh, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'll be that guy. I'll be the one who fulfills your prophecy that the Jews are going to be enslaved under my watch. He didn't have to be. Moreover, Some say that the prophecy was fulfilled through Mitzrayim, but it didn't have to be Avodas Perach, right? All it says in Brisbane and Mitzrayim is that they're going to be subjected to foreign rule. They will be enslaved, okay? But to the extent that the Egyptians enslaved them, who said, right? We know that Kadosh Baruch Hu promised they were going to be in slavery for 400 years, and they ended up only being in slavery for 210 years. So you see, it was almost double the workload. It was almost double what it had to be in order to fulfill the prophecy. So clearly, Paro went overboard. So when you have an individual who's a Rasha, like Paro, who did much more than he was supposed to do in terms of making a life miserable for the Jews, so if we would know precisely who that was, so we could search the annals of history. We'll do the archaeological research. We'll do the anthropological research. We'll find out who exactly this Paro was, the social environment he lived in, who his mother was, who his father was. Was he abused as a child? Did he become some sort of psychopath because of some traumatic experience early in life? What threw him over the edge? Right, and once this becomes like a Freudian experiment and analysis, so what do? You take away whatever Paro's responsibility was, and instead of taking Paro for what he was, he was a Rasha. He did more than he was supposed to do. And what happens when Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Paro and says, "Free the Jews"? He says, "Who is this guy? I don't know who he is." Right. So there's a danger of looking back and not even revising history, but taking a perspective on history that. That devalues the negative decision made by Paro in his position of power, because we assign all kinds of other explanations and reasons for why it happened. So anytime you focus in on a particular leader, in that case the leader of the bad guys of the Mitzrim, so we sort of blur our perspective on what actually took place. In a certain sense. On the other side of the coin, if we would be focusing on Moshe Rabbeinu too much, then we'd blur our perception of where the responsibility for Yetzias Mitzrayim actually lies, and lose our sense of focus on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Just to add a few points.
I actually have like an alternative answer, that the more it becomes something that happened in the past, and it's more like, oh, when they went out of Egypt, when Moshe took them out, then it becomes less a focus on us leaving ourselves. It's more of like like that happened in the past. Like we didn't have a Paro, we don't have like a Moshe today.
Very good.
Then
very good.
It's harder for us to picture ourselves actually.
So this comes back full circle to what we started with. The Chayav Al Liro says Atzmu Kihu Yasmi Mitzrayim. Very nice. The more that we assign it as part of an historical reality, a specific period in the past, through the players, through the characters in the story, so then we have the danger of assigning it to, relegating to only that period of history, and makes it less relevant to us. The more that this is a focus on HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Jewish people, and not the particular characters and the particular personalities of that time, so we're more directly involved. And it's something that is applicable to us as much as it is to those people who lived back then. With that in mind, well, this will close. So the Nesivos has a beautiful comment on Halach Ma'anya that we'll use to introduce what we'll talk about a little bit later as well. Halach Ma'anya is very interesting. It reads you from the Sipra Maisa, at the end of the Sefer that helps summarize some of the important points from the Nesivos and Maisa Nisim. So we're sitting down to the meal, and the way we start the entire Seder Magid is with Halach Ma'anya, where we're describing the food that was eaten by the Jewish people when they lived in Mitzrayim. And he says, "Harei anachnu nimtzom b'soch hagolus hazeh hamar v'nimhar." There's a tremendous irony to what we're doing by beginning the meal in really what is it's a low point. It's a real low point in the fact that we focus on what things were like in the Shibud. Halach Ma'anya isn't a focus on the exciting part of the Geula that is supposed to highlight the evening. Rather, it starts with the lowest point, where we try to put ourselves in the position of our forefathers in Mitzrayim, where all they had was a matzah to eat. Alach ma'ani, this is a poor man's bread that the Jews ate in Mitzrayim. So why is it that when we focus on the low points, precisely then, kol dich v'niyesiv yechol, anyone who needs something to eat, come and join us. Anyone who's lacking, join our Seder. Right? It's not the poor man who invites other people in. It's a rich man who has a lot to share, who's always trying to share the wealth, hopefully, and trying to bring other people to the same state of simcha that he's experiencing because of what he's blessed with. So why do we start the Seder with our invitation by emphasizing how lowly we are and that we're connecting to the Oni of Mitzrayim? It should be just the opposite, right? So Zakta Nesivas no. It says, Dafka, in our current state, reliving the Mariris of the Gullus, that's where we come to our greatest simcha. Why? Because the Kadosh Baruch Hu redeemed us back then, that's what gives us a promise, so to speak. There's an inherent guarantee by virtue of Yitzhiyas Mitzrayim that we will also be taken out of the current Gaulis. Unbelievable, Rav Asser. Listen to this. Taking us out of Mitzrayim, it's a mistake if we think that it was all about freedom from slavery. We mentioned earlier, why is it that when we say Pesach Matzah Maror, the last thing that's mentioned is Maror? Right? Chronologically, if you think about the symbolism, Mesivas explains later, it's out of order. The Maror is the bad times, that should be first. Then the Matzah talks about when we were in a rush to leave and the Korban Pesach, those really were simultaneous, right? So the Matzah should be, Maror should be first. Why did the Maror come last? So Zakta Nesivas, to de-emphasize the focus of Yitzhiyas Mitzrayim on getting out of Shibud. It was a very significant thing, and we're forever indebted to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for taking us out of the Shibud of Mitzrayim, the backbreaking labor, but that has to be de-emphasized. Why? Because what does Geula mean, Rabbi Yossi? Translate the word Geula.
Redemption.
That's how we like to translate it.
Redeeming.
It's not really the a complete translation. It doesn't really give you the essence of the world. What's that?
Revelation.
You know? Giloy, without an Aleph, is revelation. Geula, you're translating as redemption. There's a pasuk in Rus we referenced last week when we were talking about Mechiras Chametz that talks about the kinyan of Chalipin. And when it talks over there about the historical significance and the practice, the use of the kinyan of Chalipin in Klal Yisrael, it says, Al ha-geula v'al ha-tmura. Chalipin is used to purchase things or to trade things, to barter things. When someone is makdish, his property to the Beis HaMikdash, or when he sells his ancestral land, the Steachuza, when he buys it back, it's called Geula. So, yeah, we can translate it as redeeming. I'm redeeming it back from the Beis HaMikdash. You know, like, you redeem your prizes at the end of the night, right? So you give in your tickets in the arcade, and they'll give you something in exchange. But essentially, Geula in Tanakh is used to purchase something back from somebody else. If you sold your land to another person and you're getting it back, you're not redeeming it from him. He's not like a pawnbroker, okay? You are actually buying it back from him. You're giving him money in exchange for what you originally gave him. And in the context of the Pasuk and Rus, it's mamish. It means geula, that the process of chalipin, the kingdom of chalipin, is used to acquire something. So geula actually means to acquire something. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out of Mitzrayim, the geula was not just a freedom. The freedom was just a means to make us his, to acquire us as his nation. The Votesi, Vitzalti, I took you out, and I saved you. The Ga'alti, and I acquired you, V'lakachti, and I took you as my nation. Right? If Ge'ula is just, I set you free, there's no process that is followed through. Votesi, Vitzalti, Ga'alti, V'lakachti. Ga'alti is just sort of like disjointed. But if it's part of leading to the V'lakachti and the V'hevesi, so then it's one with Lakachti, making us his nation. So we have to translate Geula as the new relationship that was created between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael, which is what you're emphasizing, that is what's happening. Not, Moshe Rabbeinu was an intermediary, but Hashem's role in becoming his nation is where it's at. Just want to close with one point that highlights this. There's a medrash that says when the Jews were released from Mitzrayim, Paro told the Jews to sing Shira. Paro? Where did Paro come from? Paro's the last guy to be the giving a Musar Shmuz. Hey, Klal Yisrael, Now it's time for you to sing praises to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Where is that coming from? What does that mean? It's a Midrash Mitil. So I want to suggest the following pshat. Well, so why did the Jews originally become enslaved by the Egyptians? Was it because that economically the Egyptians thought that investing in real estate would raise their overall capital and increase the economic power of the Egyptians in the ancient world? So, you know, if we build a lot of cities and we increase our urban population and our urban infrastructure, so ultimately we'll become a metropolis, which will invite tourism, and you know, we'll become a power based on what we increase our through the building of the cities. Is that what happened?
No.
Is it because they figured if we have a lot of slaves, we'll be able to become more productive and sell more to the, you know, to foreign countries? No. What does it say in the Torah? It says very simply that Paro was concerned that if the Jews would multiply too quickly, the population of the Jews would, right? They would overtake the Egyptians, and they would have no reason to continue their allegiance to Paro and their loyalty to Paro, because if they were a higher in number than the Egyptians who inhabited Egypt, ultimately they could say, we don't need you anymore, and they'll take over, right? So it was all a question of allegiance. And subjecting the Jews as subjects, not as tools to increase the economy, right? So that was the case of Bosai. When they were finally freed, so Paro was not said, oh man, you know, there goes Egypt's chance of becoming the superpower on economic level. No, he no longer had the allegiance of the Jews because he had to set them free. So Mimela, if this wasn't about economics, if this was all about allegiance, Zuck Paro, if you're no longer my subjects, the first thing you should do is now recognize who your new leader is, who the new allegiance is towards, namely HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he tells him to sing Shira. But all this is only possible if we look at the Geula from Mitzrayim as a function of becoming HaKadosh Baruch Hu's people, and the new connection to Yiddishkeit that engenders, and that requires us to take upon our shoulders. So when you come tomorrow and it's the last one on the list, it's because we're de-emphasizing the physical freedom and focusing on the religious connection and the national connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that was created via Yitzhiyas Mitzrayim through Geula as acquisition, not as